Hello and welcome. For any nation to do well in a competitive world, to sustain a good standard of living, and to maintain a society of order and stability requires a sound educational system. By all accounts, the American educational system is floundering and failing. There's a lot of heated argument about just why it's not working, or more specifically, about just why so many young Americans are doing so poorly in basic reading, writing, and mathematics. But there's no disputing the sobering fact that American elementary, high school, and college students are not doing well, and that this has grave consequences for the long-term well-being of all Americans and for the nation's future. Today I'll be doing more than merely reviewing the problem. I'll talk about underlying factors behind the decline, and I'll explain how the guiding ideology of the United States, that is, the fundamental premises about life and society of this country's political and cultural leaders and the mass media, mean that the decline in American education and in American society generally will inevitably, inexorably continue. Now, first of all, a little look at the problem and some of the background. Every year, the U.S. Department of Education issues something called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It's sometimes called the nation's report card. And the results in recent years have been dismal. It shows that many high school seniors are graduating unable to read at grade level, and one in four of these high school seniors cannot even read at the most basic level. In other words, the high school degrees that are being handed out often do not represent even the skill level or the proficiency level that they're supposed to represent. States vary tremendously in their how well they do in these national tests. And generally speaking, states like California, Mississippi, Louisiana, and the District of Columbia are near the bottom of the level, and some states like North Dakota, Minnesota, and so forth tend to do near the top. And this represents a persistent gap in racial achievement by different groups in the United States. California ranks near the bottom, as already mentioned, 46 out of 52 states, according to a rating in November of 2011. And overall, something called the Center for Education Reform says that the achievement level in general, according to the Department of Education assessment, means that American schools should get an F on the nation's report card. Now, equally sobering is also a comparison about how American students do internationally around the world. An article that appeared not long ago by the Associated Press found again that American young people, this is an international test of something through something called the Program for International Student Assessment, the so-called PISA exam, 15-year-olds around the world shows that United States 15-year-olds perform about in the middle in the world at reading and science and below average on math. But out of 34 countries, this is in a December 2010 rating, the U.S. ranked 14th in reading, 17th in science, and 25th in math. These were slightly better results than in years 2003 and 2006, but far behind the highest scoring countries that include South Korea, Finland, Singapore, Shanghai in China, and Canada. The U.S. Secretary of Education called this results an absolute wake-up call for America. But as I'll show, there's been other wake-up calls that should have alarmed Americans in the past. Another table I have of international achievement comparing country by country shows, this is published in 2008, shows that Finland, Korea, Canada, Japan are all at the top, and the United States is relatively below average on competence in mathematics. Near the bottom of the list is Mexico, Turkey, and some other countries. But these international so-called PISA scores have to be looked at with a little bit of caution because they're not uptaken by the same numbers or even the same slice of the 15-year-old population in different countries. However, they do give an overall indication of the general situation. I mentioned how recently the U.S. Secretary of Education called the dismal performance of American 15-year-olds rated globally as a wake-up call. But similar alarm bells have been sounded many years earlier. Nearly 30 years ago, the U.S. Department of Education issued a very detailed report entitled A Nation at Risk. This came out in 1983. And it concluded, and I'm quoting, "We have in effect been committing an act of unthinking, unilateral educational disarmament." The chairman of the report concluded flatly, quote, "For the first time in the history of our country, the educational skills of one generation will not surpass, will not equal, will not even approach those of their parents." Now, this was in 1983, and when the report entitled A Nation at Risk was issued in that year, there was a tremendous amount of hand-wringing and discussion, and as we'll see, though, very little was done actually to turn around the situation. 19 years ago, a book was issued by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who had been the national security advisor in the Carter administration. His book is entitled Out of Control. And in the book, Brzezinski, who's a noted scholar and academic, as well as a man who played an important role in formulating American policy, identified 20 different problems in American life that he said all must be addressed if America is not going to decline and have much greater problems in the years ahead. Now, what's really remarkable about the list of 20 problems that Brzezinski identifies in his book and discusses in some detail is that, as far as I can see, every one of the problems that he identifies and discusses has grown substantially greater than when he published this book in 1993. For example, the number one problem that he mentions is national indebtedness, and he talks about a cumulative national debt in excess of $4 trillion. Well, since that book was printed or published in 1993, the national debt has grown several times that amount and is now over $15 trillion. And he mentions other problems as well. But because we're focusing in this broadcast on education, he mentions as problem number 7, poor quality secondary education. He mentions that despite relatively higher spending in terms of the percentage of gross national product in the United States, American youth is still badly uneducated as compared to most Europeans and Japanese teenagers. And that results in some 23 million adult Americans being functionally illiterate. That is nearly 10% of the American population. Now, when Brzezinski wrote this book, he did not really take into account the role of China in the world. But if the book came out today, he would certainly highlight the astonishing rise of China in the last 20 years. Some years ago, the Wall Street Journal devoted an article to reproducing an examination administered in New Jersey in 1885. It consisted of questions such as the following. Now, this is on an exam given to Americans, young Americans in the state of New Jersey in 1885. The first question was, find the product of 3 plus 4x plus 5x to the second power minus 6x to the third power, and 4 minus 5x minus 6x to the second power. Another question was, write a sentence containing a noun used as an attribute, a verb in the perfect tense potential mood, and a proper adjective. And a third question cited is, name three events of the year 1777. Which was the most important and why? Now again, this exam was not a multiple choice exam. It was an essay exam and required the person to, young American, to write out the answer. And I'm particularly struck, of course, as a historian, to the question and to name three events of the year 1777. Well, this was not an exam for graduates of a college or a university in New Jersey. It wasn't even an exam for graduates of a high school. It was a test administered in 1885 by Jersey City High School to those who were applying for admission to the high school. 15-year-olds were taking this exam and were supposed to know the answers to those questions before they would be even admitted to the high school. Now, this is in 1885. But how many young Americans today who are 15 years old could pass that exam? It seems unlikely. And this brings me to one of the, I think, biggest problems of the American educational system over the past 10, 20, 30 years, and that is the inflation of American certification over this period of time. To put it bluntly, a high school degree and a college degree don't mean what they used to mean. In effect, the value and the real skill level shown by a high school degree in America has been inflated over that period of time, so that a person with a high school degree today doesn't show anywhere near the level of skill or competence that a person with a high school degree was able to show by such a degree in 1940 or 1950. And by the same token, a college degree, a bachelor's degree, represents a far lower level of skill, achievement, of knowledge, of understanding today than it did in 1940, 1950, 1920, or so forth. One of the most important books that has come out in the last 20 or 30 years was a best-selling book entitled The Bell Curve. It caused a tremendous discussion and evoked a great deal of criticism when it came out because it took aim at some very comfortable and widely accepted assumptions about American life. But the book was written by two American scholars, Richard Herrnstein, who taught at Harvard University in psychology, and Charles Murray, a graduate of Harvard, who has also been a distinguished American scholar and author. And in this book, The Bell Curve, which is hard to summarize because it's very detailed and very weighty, much of the focus is on educational achievement and educational problems. In this book, Herrnstein and Murray point out the decline in American education really began to accelerate in the 1960s. And here's what they write. During the first half of the 20th century, education for the average American young person improved steadily, partly because the average American young person spent more time in school than previously. But much of other evidence, marshaled convincingly by economist John Bishop, indicates a steady long-term improvement in what Bishop calls general intellectual achievement that extended from the earliest date at the turn of the century into the 1960s. However, something began changing in the 1960s. from the mid-1960s began a period of decline, as manifested most notably by the fall in SAT scores. And Murray and Herrnstein point out that SAT scores began dropping rapidly, precipitously, from about 1963 to 1980, and they've stayed low in the years since then. Murray and Herrnstein, in their book, The Bell Curve, identify a number of reasons, or probable reasons, for the decline in SAT scores and the general decline in American educational achievement during the 1960s and 1970s. But one of the most important they emphasize is the shift away in American education from educating the most gifted young Americans, and instead putting the emphasis on trying to raise the level of everybody. The result has been a tremendous reallocation of educational resources and of money in American life to try to bring about an equality in achievement and ability that, in the view of Herrnstein and Murray, and I think of many others, including myself, is really utopian and impossible. In fact, Herrnstein and Murray conclude, and I'm reading from a recommendation they make in this book, the following. Most people think, now this is written again in 1994, so this isn't anything new. Most people think that American public education is in terrible shape, and any number of allegations seem to confirm it. But a search of the data does not reveal that the typical American school child in the past would have done any better on tests of academic skill. An American youth with an average IQ is probably better prepared academically now than ever before. The problem with American education is confined mainly to one group of students, the cognitively gifted. Among the most gifted students, SAT scores started falling in the mid-1960s, and the verbal scores have not recovered since. One reason is that disadvantaged students have been in and gifted students out for 30 years. Herrnstein and Murray conclude, "We urge primarily not a set of new laws, but a change of heart within the ranks of educators. Until the latter half of this century, that is 1950s, 1960s, it was taken for granted that one of the chief purposes of education was to educate the gifted, not because they deserved it through their own merit, but because, for better or for worse, the future of society was so dependent on them." And Murray and Herrnstein go on to note, "It needs to be said openly. The people who run the United States, create its jobs, expand its technologies, cure its sick, teach in its universities, administer its cultural, political, and legal institutions, are drawn mainly from a thin layer of cognitive ability at the top. It matters enormously not just that the people in the top few centiles of ability get to college, or even many of them go to elite colleges, but that they are educated well. One theme of this chapter is that since the 1960s, while a cognitive elite has become increasingly segregated from the rest of the country, the quality of education they received has been degraded. They continue to win positions, money, prestige, and success in competition with their less gifted fellow citizens, but they are less well educated in the ways that make smart children into wise adults." Now, this is an extremely important point. It should be obvious to most people that the emphasis on trying to bring up everybody while degrading the education of the most able, the people who will be playing the most important role as leaders in society, is going to have very harmful long-term consequences. But this is an expression of a tremendous emphasis in the United States on egalitarianism, on trying to bring everybody up to a certain level. And as we'll see in the second half of this broadcast, this has to do in large measure to the effort to overcome so-called racism and bring about a equality in performance of different racial groups in the United States. But the result has been a catastrophic one. Now, most people on a certain level realize the basic truth of this. People might object to elitism and giving greater emphasis to educating the most gifted or the most able or to the small percentage of people in every society who are the doers and shakers and organizers and so forth, and instead emphasizing what's good for everybody or trying to uplift everybody. But most people recognize something like this when it comes to things they care about. For example, in sports, no one would think of trying to make everybody a good basketball player. The emphasis by anybody who cares about having a winning basketball team is on identifying those who have the most innate ability and then training them as best as possible and putting tremendous effort on making sure that the most capable inherently as potentially good basketball players are then trained to be as good as possible. In other words, even people who are uncomfortable with talk of elitism when it comes to cultural life or political life or so forth are eagerly embracing that concept when it comes to sports. But this shift that began in the 1960s and has continued to this day on trying to spread resources around so that everybody is raised to a certain level began also at the same time during the 1960s when a tremendous emphasis changed in America's attitude about the relation between the races as well. And this triumph of a kind of egalitarianism in American life during the 1960s, as applied in educational life, has led to the crisis that we now see all around us today. Perhaps the most controversial aspect of the book, The Bell Curve, by Herrnstein and Murray, is the emphasis each of them puts on the importance of heredity and biology. That is the single best predictor of how well people will do in school or in business or in life is basic intelligence, that is IQ. And this is a single best predictor of how well people are going to do overall. To put it another way, basic intelligence is a far better predictor of how well people are going to do academically and in other aspects of life than is either income or background or socialization, income level, and so forth. The importance of innate or inherent abilities is an obvious fact of life for anyone who's experienced much of life. We all understand this on a certain level. We understand that some people are, from the very beginning, from the get-go, are more inquisitive, more curious, and smarter than other kids, and that this is going to be with them in life and is going to give them a tremendous advantage. People, of course, understand that in sports, no one in his right mind would expect that people with an average height of 5'2" are going to be trained to be as good basketball players whose average height is 5'9" or 6' and above. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume and come back in a few minutes with the second half of this broadcast. Hello and welcome back. It's no coincidence that the fall in SAT scores and the beginning of the dramatic fall in American educational levels over the past 20, 30 years began during the 1960s as part of a general shift in discussion about the very dicey, emotion-laden issue of race. The fact is that persistently, black Americans have done less well in school and generally in society than white Americans. And there are two basic explanations for this disparity. One explanation, which is the official one in the United States, is that the disparity in achievement between blacks and whites is due to social and economic environmental factors, that if these social economic factors and the environmental issues and the nurturing can be adjusted and tweaked and improved, then the gap in performance between blacks and whites, not only economically but also academically, will be narrowed and then disappear. The other explanation is that the differences in achievement, the difference in achievement, scholastically and other ways, between black and white, is due to inherent genetic or biological factors. That is, to be blunt about it, blacks on average are not as intelligent as whites or East Asians or other groups that routinely and persistently do better. But politically and culturally in our society, that explanation is considered unacceptable. It doesn't matter what the facts are. An ability to look rationally and objectively at the issue of race and performance is simply not possible in a society that's committed to egalitarianism in the way that the United States is. Now, in the 20th century, it's often said that the most radically egalitarian society was the Soviet Union or communist societies. Well, in many ways, that's true. Certainly, the ideology supposes that society is heading towards a leveling and egalitarian utopia. But even in the high heyday of the Soviet Union, the Soviets were never so stupid as to ignore basic realities about genetics and intelligence and ability in the way that the United States does today. In other words, even in the height of the Stalin era, during the Soviet period, the Soviet educational system remained a very rigorous one, and that in spite of many other problems, graduates of Soviet schools were well-trained and well-educated, on average better so than in the United States, and certainly in the United States over the past 30, 40 years. It was during the 1960s that, in the early 70s, that the United States government and society and mass media began a concerted campaign to, as was said at the time, eliminate the last vestiges of racism and to bring about equality, not only of opportunity, but of performance among the different racial groups in the United States. Well, the achievement of that goal has proven to be completely elusive. The gap in performance, academically and in other ways, between the racial groups in America has remained persistent, in spite of tremendous amounts of political policy, reallocation of money, and so forth, including efforts, so-called affirmative action efforts, that were supposed to start showing results many years ago, but which are still in place because the promised results have remained elusive to this day. With specific regard to schools, many theories are advanced in our society to try to explain the racial gaps in performance. It's said that black and Hispanic schools do not get enough money, that their classes are too big. There's complaints that students are segregated from whites, or that minorities do not have enough teachers of their own race. These are some of the explanations that have been offered to explain the differences in achievement, the gap in achievement between whites and blacks in particular, without dealing with the touchy issue of genetics and biology. Now, every one of those explanations has been thoroughly investigated. But in fact, urban schools where non-whites are concentrated often get more money than suburban white schools. And so black and Hispanics are not shortchanged in budget or classroom size. It also seems that the race of the teacher has no noticeable effect on learning. For example, Asians, East Asians, people of Japanese, young people of Japanese, Chinese, Korean background, outperform whites regardless of the race of the teacher. Nor does the presence of whites in a classroom significantly raise or lower the scores of students of other races. It's also completely clear, after years of study, that money is not the problem. From the early 1970s to the present, school year per pupil spending more than doubled in real terms. One institute, the Cato Institute, calculates that when capital costs are included, the Los Angeles School District, for example, spends more than $25,000 per student per year. The school district of District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., spends more than $28,000 per year, which is well above the amount spent for per pupil per year in most white areas of the country. But nevertheless, neither of those two districts do well. In fact, the performance levels are far below the national average. One result of the tremendous emphasis on trying to narrow the gap between performance of blacks and whites through affirmative action programs and other money reallocation programs has been to create greater and greater frustration, disappointment, and anger because the results have remained elusive. And because a realistic grappling with this issue is impossible politically and culturally because of the ideology of American society, the prevailing view that is accepted by our political leaders and by the mass media, the result is, of course, greater and greater anger that the promised results have not come about. As already mentioned, even income levels are not a good predictor of how well students will do in school as compared to IQ or race. In all racial groups, students from wealthy households tend to score better than those who are poor, but income does not explain the group differences. One study carried out showed that while white fourth graders living in poverty scored higher by about an equivalent of a half year's instruction than black fourth graders who are not poor. And these differences actually increased the more time went on, including in high school. On the 2009 math and verbal SAT tests, whites from families with incomes of less than $20,000 a year not only had an averaged combined score that was 117 points higher than the average for all blacks, the white students from this poorest group outscored by 12 points even blacks who came from families with incomes of $160,000 to $200,000 a year. Now, to deal with this without touching the issue of genetics or IQ, people have come up with all sorts of possible solutions to try to deal with all of this. For example, in heavily non-white schools in New York, Chicago, and Washington, there's been an experimental program to pay children cash to come to school, turn in homework, and get better grades. In Washington, in 2009, a program jointly funded by the district and Harvard University was paying students as much as $100 every 2 weeks to show up and turn in homework. A program in the year 2008 at a high school in Waterbury, Connecticut, at a high school with an 81% non-white student body, was paying $100 for each advanced placement test that the kids could pass. Others who have tried to offer explanations or solutions to this have come up with even more creative answers. A nonprofit group in Chicago filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, claiming that black and Hispanic kids were demoralized and dropped out of school because they're more likely to be held back in public schools for doing poorly on standardized tests. And therefore, this nonprofit group said, the tests themselves should simply be eliminated. In Atlanta, one result was that dozens of teachers were under criminal investigation in 2010 for altering answers to improve student scores on state standardized tests. A group of prominent black pastors held a press conference to denounce what they called a witch hunt and explained that teachers were just trying to help the children. In Los Angeles, after years of poor performance, the city school district opened a new model high school in July 2005 that was to help solve many of these problems. Well, the school had a heated pool, a ballet studio, a fully equipped chef's kitchen, and shiny new computers, all divided into five learning communities of 600 to 700 students who would have a sense of belonging. But the results remained elusive. In the first 9 months, this South Los Angeles area high school number one was tops in the district in violent crimes. There were so many fistfights in the restroom that classrooms were locked during class and adults escorted students to the restroom. Lunchtime riots in December 2005 resulted in 34 arrests and sent 10 students to the hospital. Well, the fighting was taking place above all between Mexican and black students, in spite of the fact that there were posters around the school proclaiming black and brown equals peace. In spite of the tremendous efforts to improve the environment of the high school, the racial tension persisted and the lack of achievement also persisted. In Chicago, during the 2008-2009 school year, 37 public school students were shot dead. The most ambitious effort to try to deal with the obvious floundering and failure of the American educational system was a very ambitious law called the No Child Left Behind Act. It was enacted in 2001 with overwhelming support by leaders of both the Democratic and Republican parties. It was proposed not only by President George W. Bush, who was a Republican, in January of 2001, it was co-authored by Senator Edward Kennedy, perhaps the most prominent Democratic leader at the time, and had, as I mentioned, broad bipartisan support. It passed the House of Representatives in 2001 by a vote of 384 to 45, and it passed the United States Senate by 91 to 8. That is, with overwhelming popular support of both political parties. And it was signed into law in January 2002. Now, the No Child Left Behind Act is ambitious, but it ignores basic reality, and any person with life experience, any person with a sense of history, could have predicted exactly what happened. The No Child Left Behind Act has been a failure, and it has failed because it was not based on reality. One of the most important provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act is that schools that did not show what's called, quote, adequate yearly progress would be labeled as being in need of improvement, and then after a period of time, money would be spent to try to improve things with tutoring, and if they still persisted in failure to show adequate yearly improvement, then the school would be labeled as requiring corrective action. And then finally, there would be measures to restructure the school altogether if it didn't succeed. Well, the result, as time goes on and as penalty provisions start to threaten to kick in, The result has been that state after state has been applying for a waiver from the provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act. And currently, 19 states have already been granted waivers from the provisions of this No Child Left Behind Act. Of course, the act is hated by teachers who feel that they're being penalized and punished, or the schools are also being penalized and punished and blamed for the lack of achievement of the young people in their classrooms. A predictable consequence of the No Child Left Behind Act is that because there is such an emphasis on performance in tests that measure reading ability and mathematics, that the teachers and the schools are under tremendous pressure to, as they say, teach to the test. That is, to put maximum resources on making sure that the children in the school do well on the tests by neglecting everything else. The result has been a tremendous reduction in funding for subjects such as history, arts, language, and music in order to give more time and resources to mathematics and English to do as well as possible on these tests. In fact, since the year 2007, almost 71% of schools, more than two-thirds of schools in the country, have reduced instruction time in these subjects, such as history, arts, language, and music, and so forth, in order to give more time and resources to the two areas that are tested as required by the No Child Left Behind Act. One consequence of the No Child Left Behind Act, with the allocation of millions of dollars in resources, has been some improvement in testing on math and English, but the results have fallen far short of the goals and expectations of the program. In fact, there's now a wide consensus that the goals of the No Child Left Behind Act were unrealistic from the outset. One state superintendent in Alabama said, "There's a fallacy in the law, and everybody knows it," he said. He mentioned, there's too many variables. It simply is not possible that the goals could be achieved, he says, in the state of Alabama, and ultimately has benefited no one. Charles Murray, the co-author of the book The Bell Curve, wrote of the law, quote, "The United States Congress, acting with large bipartisan majorities, at the urging of the president, enacted as the law of the land that all children are to be above average." Well, one of the reasons why test scores have seemed to be better than they have has been a great deal of, to put it bluntly, corruption or creative reclassification. For example, in order to hide the fact of a high dropout rate at the Sharpston High School in Houston, 463 of the 1,700 students that left during the 2001-2000 school year were reported as having left, but not as dropping out. The dropout rate was reported to be only 1.5%, but in fact the dropout rate at the high school was 33-50%, because the school didn't report the kids that were leaving as having dropped out. The amount of money that has been squandered in this No Child Left Behind Act is astonishing. In the fiscal year 2007 alone, government budgeted $24.4 billion for the No Child Left Behind Act programs. But the results, of course, as I mentioned, have been dismal. Charles E. Finn, Jr., a former education official in the Reagan administration, put it this way in 2009, quote, "This is nearly unrelenting tale of woe and disappointment. If there's any good news here, I can't find it." But an important point to keep in mind about this No Child Left Behind Act is not that it's a mistake, but that it's based on completely false premises and assumptions about life and society. It's based upon a notion of equality and a notion about the malleability of human beings and an ignorance or a deliberate ignorance about biology, race, and genetics that is terminally dangerous for any society. Commenting on the No Child Left Behind Act, Time magazine even commented, "There was something always slightly insane about the No Child Left Behind Act, the ambitious education law often described as the Bush administration's signature domestic achievement. For one thing, in the view of many educators, the law's 2014 goal, which calls for all public school students in grades 4 through 8 to be achieving on grade level in reading and math, is something no educational system anywhere on earth has ever accomplished. Even more unrealistic, every kid, except for 3% with serious handicaps or other issues, is supposed to be achieving on grade level every year, climbing in lockstep on an ever more challenging ladder. This flies in the face of all sorts of research showing that children start off in different places academically and grow at different rates." The point here that I want to stress again is that the prevailing ideology in America, the assumption that it's possible to create a colorblind, racially equal society, a society in which genetics and biology are not important, is utopian. And every effort to try to create such a society is doomed to failure. But the political leaders of our country, the mass media, and so forth, are wedded to this idea for political reasons that are rooted in assumptions that American public widely accepts about a society in which, as the Declaration of Independence says, all men are created equal. Now, leaving aside what Thomas Jefferson meant when he wrote those words, that has come to mean in America a society in which human beings are looked upon as completely malleable and able to perform at a level of achievement regardless of their real intelligence level and their basic abilities. The problems are even more deep-rooted than that. I'm particularly interested in the way in which history is distorted in American education. Increasingly, over the past 20, 30 years, American textbooks and courses have presented history in a way to make different ethnic groups all feel good about their own past. The result has been a ludicrous distortion of American and world history. At the same time that the role of different groups is distorted and skewed in our classrooms and school textbooks, of course, the emphasis by law continues in schools across the country on making sure that the lessons of the Holocaust are never forgotten. In fact, most schools in the United States or school districts require, and other school districts carry this out as a normal part of their classroom operations, to put this big emphasis on this. But this lack of realism, both in history and in the expectations of performance, are based on false notions about life and about society that mean that the problems will not be overcome and will persist in the years ahead. Thank you for joining me for this broadcast. I hope you'll join me for the next Mark Weber Report.